Today is Thursday, June 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Special Counsel Robert Mueller will publicly testify to Congress about his Russia investigation.
The Russians attacked our Democratic election with the goal of helping Trump win the election. The Trump campaign welcomed that help, and that's the words of the report.
Highlights of the first Democratic debate for some of the in the large field vying for the presidency looking to take on Donald Trump. We'll have that also ahead. Madonna uses her star power to take on gun control in the United States. It's all on today's International Edition. Democrats faced off in a primetime fight Wednesday night for 2 hours in the first debate of the 2020 presidential campaign, the unofficial starting line for the party's quest to wrest the White House from Donald Trump and deny him a second term. Frontrunner of this first group, Liberal Senator Elizabeth Warren, on the question about the economy.
It's doing great for a thinner and thinner slice at the top. It's doing great for giant drug companies. It's just not doing great for people who are trying to get a prescription filled. It's doing great for people who want to invest in private prisons, just not for the African Americans and Latinx whose families are torn apart, whose lives are destroyed, and whose communities are ruined. It's doing great for giant oil companies that want to drill everywhere, just not for the rest of us who are watching climate change bear down upon us. When you've got a government, when you've got an economy that does great for those with money and isn't doing great for everyone else, that is corruption, pure and simple. We need to call it out. We need to attack it head on. And we need to make structural change in our government, in our economy, and in our country.
And the issue of immigration, front and center, of course, following reports of children being held in horrific warehouses and the grim photo that has gone viral of a Salvadorian man who drowned alongside his 23-month-old daughter while trying to cross the Rio Grande in Texas, have been front and center in the news. Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his daughter Valeria were swept away by the current near the Mexico and Texas border this week in the Rio Grande. Here's what Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro said about that situation.
If I were president today, I would sign an executive order that would get rid of Trump's zero tolerance policy, the remain in Mexico policy, and the metering policy. This metering policy is basically what prompted Oscar and Valeria to make that risky swim across the river. They have been playing games with people who are coming and trying to seek asylum at our ports of entry. Oscar and Valeria went to a port of entry, and then they were denied the ability to make an asylum claim. So they got frustrated, and they tried to cross the river, and they died.
Well, joining us now from Miami, where the debate was held, is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, you are at a debate party this evening, or you were, for women of color. Thanks so much for taking some time out to join us. It's been a crazy night.
That is for sure. No problem at all.
So what are some of the reactions that voters that you were with had to say about the debate?
Well, I will say it was certainly an interesting spot to be in when some of these Democratic presidential candidates decided to answer in Spanish. We saw Beto O'Rourke and Cory Booker give their answers in Spanish. And I will say that voters of color, particularly women of color, are very sensitive to being pandered to. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of those voters tell me before the debate even started that they didn't like it when candidates did that. So when Beto O'Rourke began speaking in Spanish, there were these big swells of boos and kind of, oh my God, is he really going to try and speak in Spanish? Hmm. So it's really interesting to see these candidates try to reach out because, as we know, Florida is a very important electoral state. You really need to win here to be able to win the presidency.
Absolutely. And I assume, were they all Democrats that you were with?
Pretty much. I mean, from the interviews I was doing before the debate started, it was really a matter of these voters sitting down and deciding which one of these 20 Democratic presidential candidates they'll vote for next year.
And did any of the candidates stand out to the group you were with that you seem to be hearing a lot about more than some of the others?
I think, you know, the consensus is emerging, and it was certainly true for the people I was sitting with in the room, is that Castro really did a great job of drilling down on the details of this immigration issue that really has the entire nation, it's the attention captured. We're really hashing out this debate in detail because of that photo you mentioned of the father and daughter who died drowned in the river. Mm-hmm. Castro, it seemed, really was able to address these problems, to give bold new solutions, which these voters were telling me they were looking for, that it's time to move past some of the old debates and really look for new solutions.
And was that one of the main issues that those people were concerned about, or what were some of the main things that they feel are the most important that they're looking for?
Well, because we're here in Florida, criminal justice and issues of incarceration are very important here. A large portion of the population has been incarcerated or is somehow connected to the criminal justice issues. Of course, last year, felons just regained the right to vote here in Florida. That's something that a lot of the people I spoke to today had organized and worked very hard to achieve. And they thought that because of all of this work here in Florida on criminal justice issues, it had invigorated voters and gotten them more involved in the process, and that there would be this huge upswell of interest during the 2020 presidential election here.
And as you said, Florida is such an important state. It is a must win for anyone who wants to win the presidency, for sure. While we're just in the primaries right now, do these voters feel like Florida is in play and that a Democrat could actually take Florida from Donald Trump?
That could be tough. You know, Donald Trump won over Hillary Clinton last time around by about 100,000 votes. The women of color I was speaking to this evening really had the sense that if they mobilize these voters, the Latino voters, the African American voters who didn't turn out in 2016 for Hillary Clinton, then the fact of pushing Florida over to the Democratic Party could be very real.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure they're probably already activating to try to see what they can do to make that happen, I would imagine.
They were doing it tonight, that's for sure.
All right. Well, we appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. We'll let you get back to your work. That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. She is in Florida, in Miami, Florida, where the debates are happening. Thanks again. Well, while the crowded field has been courting voters in key states for several months already, the vast majority of the nation has yet to pay close attention to the ambitious and diverse field. The overall field is so large that we will have a second group of 10 Democrats, led by early frontrunner Joe Biden, debating later tonight. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Will Americans be kept in the dark about foreign efforts to alter the 2020 election? Europe urges Iran not to renege on nuclear deal commitments. The U.S. Senate approves funds to address the border crisis. And a new report warns devastating Islamic State comeback within sight. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at VOAnews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Former special counsel Robert Mueller has agreed to provide open testimony in public before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee next month. Mueller led a nearly two-year investigation into Russian interference into the 2016 election and allegations that President Donald Trump obstructed justice by trying to shut the probe down. The chairman of the two panels, Representative Gerald Nadler and Representative Adam Schiff, announced in a letter late Tuesday that they had issued subpoenas seeking to compel Mueller to testify and that he agreed to be there on July 17th. Nadler said the special counsel's desire for his report to stand on its own, but that he respected the special counsel's desire for the report to stand on its own, but that the public deserves to hear from him directly.
I think it's very important that the American people hear from Mr. Mueller as to what he did find, what the results of that two-year investigation were, and not have to rely on the misinformation spread by the Attorney General or on reading the report, which most people won't do.
Well, Trump has been highly critical of the process, repeatedly calling the investigation a witch hunt And his reaction shortly after Tuesday's announcement about Mueller testifying came in the form of a tweet. He wrote, "Presidential harassment," and then later complained about it to the press.
This is a disgraceful thing, and now we keep... I heard about it last night, and I just said, does it ever end? At what point does it end? It's a disgrace.
Well, joining us to talk more about what we can expect is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. So Mueller apparently wouldn't testify willingly, and they had to issue these subpoenas. Why do you think he wouldn't want to set the record straight on his investigation, given how much it seems to have been distorted?
He may or may not have wanted to talk, but he wasn't going to talk unless he was subpoenaed.
Why?
I often dealt with people who were willing to testify, but for reasons of cover, they wanted to be subpoenaed. And so they can say, hey, I didn't volunteer. I didn't have any choice. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
But in his last statement, he said he hoped it would be his last. And he said, you know, that there's nothing else he would be able to offer. Do you think that this will still have value, even if he just basically repeats what is in that report? Because obviously the public probably would be more receptive to hearing it from him than trying to read 400 plus pages.
That's a great question. Bob Mueller is not bombastic. He's not an orator. He is a calm, deliberate speaker. He said the last time he spoke that the report speaks for him, and I think he believes that. So in one sense, people will be disappointed because he's not going to get up and rant and foam at the mouth. However, I think that Mueller's presentation, while it is not dramatic and bombastic, can be enormously effective because he shows seriousness of purpose. And I think that is the potential value. I think that anybody who believes that there's some bombshells going to come out is going to be sadly disappointed.
But weren't there bombshells basically in the Mueller report in and of themselves?
Having that in a report is very different from having him say to a House hearing with all the press that's there, that is going to be there, having him say it there. And so I think it could be important.
Do you think that lawmakers will be more inclined to want to potentially proceed with impeachment hearings after Mueller testifies?
I don't think so, at least not in a rational way. I mean, that is, they may say, okay, now it's the barricade.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that Mr. Mueller is going to say anything that a rational person would say, well, that puts me over the line.
We heard from the president in tweets really lashing out about the whole thing and accusing Robert Mueller of committing a crime and supposedly deleting emails and factually incorrect statements nonetheless. Maybe that could be why Mueller has been so hesitant to testify, because it's likely going to get politicized and he's very apolitical. Agree?
If the question is Bob Mueller afraid of Trump, the answer is absolutely not. Mr. Mueller has a reputation that goes back for many years. Mr. Trump has a reputation that goes back many years as well.
Mm-hmm.
Only his reputation isn't very good. Mueller's is.
All right, Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Top U.S. and Iranian officials are continuing to fire verbal warning shots at each other while insisting they want to avoid war. Beyond a traditional confrontation, though, there are concerns about cyber warfare. The U.S. has already been conducting operations on Iranian targets, but now current and former government officials are warning businesses in the United States to be prepared for cyber attacks from Iran in retaliation. Joining us to discuss is Jamil Jaffer, executive at IronNet Cybersecurity and director of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. What exactly is happening here? It sounds like Iran is becoming a bigger concern with regard to cyber attacks. We're learning that U.S. businesses are being warned to get ready for a barrage of digital retaliation.
Right. Well, we've seen from DHS very directly a concern and a warning to the industry to be prepared to respond to or be prepared for potential cyber threats emanating from Iran and potentially the use of wiper viruses like they used in Shamoon against Saudi Arabia. So certainly that's a concern. And it does appear from the reporting that the U.S. is getting more aggressive in cyberspace, which to my view is an appropriate response. You know, obviously these are attacks in physical space that Iran is conducting against civilian shipping and against a U.S. drone. The U.S. is a variety of tools they might deploy to respond to that. Cyber is one of them. And here, using this tool seems to make a lot of sense, because if you don't push back against activity, that activity is going to continue to happen.
What exactly is this wiper virus, and what does it do?
Yeah, so we've known that Iran has the capability to take action against computer systems and delete data for a while. We saw that happen in the case of Las Vegas Sands Corporation back almost 5, 6, 7 years ago now. We saw it deployed again repeatedly, actually, against Saudi Arabian and Middle Eastern countries, Qatari RasGas, Saudi Aramco back in the day, and then more recently, a variety of Saudi government institutions. So we know that the U.S. government has definitively attributed that attack to Iran, and we know that that they have this capability to delete data and make systems unusable at times.
Are there any other concerns as far as what targets Iran might try to go for? What other sorts of targets are officials here concerned that Iran might go after?
Well, we know that historically Iran has targeted critical infrastructure sectors in the United States. We know that they conducted DDoS, distributed denial of service attacks, against the U.S. banking system back in 2015, roughly time frame. We also know from public reporting that they sought to gain access to dams and other systems. So we know that the Iranians have an interest in critical infrastructure systems and at least taking some measure of disruptive activity to at least slow them down in the case of the banks. And we know that Iran has the capability to levy destructive attacks and has chosen to do so against the U.S. private sector and against our allies in the case of Saudi Aramco, Qatari RasGas, and the like. So we know all these things, and then we know that the situation, the tension is getting hotter with Iran. You know, General Keith Alexander, the former director of NSA and the CEO of IronNet Cybersecurity, where I worked, and I recently wrote an op-ed laying out this threat about a month and a half ago, where we said, look, with the tensions rising in the Middle East, there's a very high likelihood that Iran is likely to use terrorism and or cyber activities against the United States to respond to a U.S. pressure, and that appears to now potentially be happening, or at least the threat seems to be much more present, and the U.S. government is talking about it.
All right, Jamil Jaffer, he is the executive at IronNet Cybersecurity, also the director of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. Thanks so much for bringing us that information. We appreciate it very much. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza clashed with Israeli forces Tuesday as they protested an economic initiative launched by the White House Tuesday at a conference in Manama, Bahrain. The multi-billion-dollar Peace to Prosperity proposal to boost Palestinian and neighboring Arab states' economy is part of a Middle East peace plan heralded by President Trump as the, quote, deal of the century and spearheaded by his son-in-law and White House advisor Jared Kushner. It also comes as National Security Advisor John Bolton has been meeting with leaders of Israel and Russia. Joining us to talk more about this is Gulf and Israeli-Palestinian expert Jonathan Shanzer. He is the Senior Vice President with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
First of all, I think that it's actually a success that you have the three national security advisors sitting down in one place talking about these issues, because really for the last 5, 6 years, what we've seen is just ongoing tension between the U.S., Russia, and Israel about what's been happening in Syria, everything from Iran's presence there to ISIS to very crowded skies over Syria that Russia technically controls. So there's an opportunity here to talk about Iran's presence in Syria, to talk about the mechanism for stopping weapons that are flowing into Lebanon to benefit Hezbollah. And there's even an opportunity to talk about what the future of Syria might look like. And that may yet be the most important beginning of a discussion to emerge from these meetings.
Sounds like you do think good things could come out of this meeting, whether it's super substantive or just that the conversation is going on.
I think that having a dialogue is probably positive in this case. I don't expect the Russians to capitulate. I don't expect the Russians to become friends of the United States. There is even still a bit of tension between the Russians and the Israelis because the Israelis continue to strike at Iranian targets using airspace that Russia controls. So there is going to be tension, but having a dialogue to try to address some of these issues is undoubtedly important and could, in fact, yield some positive results.
And, of course, it comes at a time when there are rising tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Where does Israel stand on this? I mean, obviously, John Bolton is pretty much a hawk when it comes to these issues. There's talk that he would prefer to have regime change. Do you see that as what Israel would ultimately like as well? Or do you think that they support trying for diplomacy with Iran?
I would say this, that the Israelis were very happy when the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal last year. They had been very critical of the deal since it was put into effect, or at least agreed to, in 2015. I would argue that the Israelis certainly wouldn't mind to see regime change and certainly wouldn't mind to see the United States dispatch this regime or its military in short order. But I think also the Israelis understand that things are more complicated than that and that for now they are almost certainly supporting the Trump administration's continued efforts to isolate Iran diplomatically and economically through sanctions.
Let's talk a little bit about this Middle East peace proposal that Jared Kushner is unveiling. What do you know about it, and what do you think about it?
Unfortunately, we don't know much about this. I mean, right now there's a new economic plan that has been unveiled, and that's what's being discussed currently in Bahrain at a fairly high-level conference. But the problem is that the Bahrain conference is only one piece of this. There's also the political side, which is really the meat of the plan. And this would basically determine how the Trump administration looks at all of the thorny issues, Jerusalem, borders, refugees, all the things that have perpetuated the Palestinian-Israeli conflict for so long. So right now we're dealing with only just a piece of this, not looking at the whole. And so we're at this point, I think, going to have to continue to wait before we can really serve up judgment.
I do hear critics saying that it's pretty much a non-starter for the Palestinians because it doesn't say anything about a two-state solution, the vision for Jared Kushner and the Trump administration.
Well, I would say this, that the Palestinians are coming into this angry. They've seen support from the United States economically. They've seen that begin to evaporate. The Israelis are obviously pleased because the United States moved its embassy to Jerusalem, and that has angered the Palestinians as well. We've closed our embassy here in Washington, and that's angered them. And so there are lots of reasons why they don't like the Trump administration or don't like its policies. And we really don't know yet whether there's going to be talk of a serious two-state solution or whether it's been widely rumored that it could end up being more of an economic plan where they invest slowly over time in the Palestinian territories with an eye towards a two-state solution further on down the line when the Palestinians are more politically and economically stable. But regardless, I think we're seeing some pushback from the Palestinians. The thing that's difficult, I think, for the Palestinians right now is that their default position, even when the plans that have been presented to them in the past have been more beneficial, their default position has been no. So they're once again rejecting an American plan. And I think it's not exactly a terrific look for them, particularly because others from the Arab world are in attendance and they are talking about a Palestinian future without the Palestinians being there.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. That's Jonathan Shanzer. He's a senior vice president with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, this week, Zimbabwe is hosting the first United Nations and Africa Union Summit on Wildlife. The country is seeking permission to sell its $600 million stock of elephant ivory and rhino horns to fund conservation programs. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from the resort town of Victoria Falls, those living near game parks have other issues they want addressed.
Gertrude lives in Monzuma Village on the edge of Wange National Park, Zimbabwe's biggest wildlife reserve. Dube has a problem with hyenas who have eaten all seven of the goats she once owned, leaving her with this empty crow.
If you leave your goat or cattle in the wild for the night, they will be eaten by the hyena. I believe there's a huge number of hyenas in the bush, because five or six animals can be eaten from one kraal by a hyena in one night.
But there is another bigger issue for the villagers in the UNAU Wildlife Summit taking place this week in Victoria Falls. Elephants.
We love wild animals. They are a part of nature. But some wild animals, such as elephants, lions, or buffaloes, we're afraid of them as they kill. When people hear of elephants in the area, even school children fear going to school as they kill.
Conflict between humans and wildlife is one of the agenda items at this week's summit. But Zimbabwean officials have a different forecast than Dube. Zimbabwe and its neighbors, Botswana and Namibia, are home to over 60% of the world's elephants. The countries want to end an international ban on trading in raw ivory, imposed 30 years ago in hopes of protecting elephant populations. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa says the country has about $600 million worth of elephant ivory and rhino horns in stock, mostly taken from animals that died of natural causes. Mnangagwa says the money raised would allow Zimbabwe to better manage and conserve its wildlife populations.
If we are allowed to dispose the same and agreed parameters, the revenue derived therefrom would suffice to finance our operational conservation efforts for the next 2 decades. We encourage a process where accruing benefits from natural resources are fairly and equitably shared among communities living within wildlife areas.
That will certainly be good news and Dube and others who are in conflict with wildlife. They want to benefit from Zimbabwe's natural resources, such as this national park, one of the seven wonders, which President Emmerson Mnangagwa encouraged tourists to visit to develop the economy. After all, the UNAU summit is about how wildlife can develop Africa's economy. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Pop icon Madonna is using her star power to address gun violence in America. A newly released video opens with a warning of graphic and difficult images. You'll see, including people being gunned down in the Pulse nightclub in 2016, a bloody attack that left 49 people dead. The video, titled God Control, makes a strong statement against gun violence and says the graphic videos are the reality of what happens when someone is shot by a gun. The video is her strong call to action. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
joke. I don't know if it's true.